Bienvenidos a un nuevo episodio del podcast de K-Fan, un espacio en el que aprender de emprendedores que han creado, escalado y a veces vendido empresas tecnológicas.
El episodio de esta semana lo patrocina Factorial, el software de recursos humanos que hace el trabajo pesado por ti. Comienza a gestionar tu empresa con reportes avanzados, nóminas, un gestor de vacaciones, control horario y mucho más. Factorial, la asesoría laboral del siglo XXI. Descubre más en factorialhr.es.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here with Pablo. How are you, Pablo?
Hi, fine.
And we're here with Carmen and Hugo of Samaipata. How are you?
Hi, guys.
Hi, hola.
So, first, before we go into more into detail of Samaipata, tell us a bit about your history and how you made your way into venture.
You want to start?
Okay, sure. Hi, so I'm Carmen. I actually had quite an unusual way into venture, which I think is what most people say. Anyways, I started my career in politics. I quickly realized I had to do something else. Launch a startup, a crowdfunding marketplace for journalism. That didn't take off, but it was a great kind of first touch point into entrepreneurship and also the VC ecosystem in Spain back then. But I went to serve my time at Morgan Stanley, went moved to London, did a few years of investment banking there. And from there, I jumped into VC, into a fund. It's called Felix Capital. They're a Series A, B, and now C fund investing into digital lifestyle. I joined before the fund was launched. So that was quite a really good experience on how to get a fund off the ground. We deployed fund 120 million in companies like Farfetch, Deliveroo, Goop in the US. And then I moved to Samaipata to open the UK office. And there I met Auro.
What were you doing in politics? And this is politics in Spain.
Yes, it was politics in Spain. So this is quite embarrassing. But basically, I got very good grades in university. So I was in the news. So
what did you study?
Law and business. Derecho y ADE. And so I was in the news and saw this lady who used to be the president of Congress in Spain, Luisa Fernanda Rudi, had just won the elections in Aragon, and she basically did this very Spanish thing of calling my dad because she didn't call me.
Because she knew that you're dad.
Well, like there was some touch point somehow, okay. Right? And I mean, it was completely unexpected, especially for my dad, who didn't know why she was calling him. And then I just joined, like she asked, she's a very smart person and basically decided to build a cabinet that was completely independent, nobody party related. And so it was the chief of staff and two other advisors, non-party related. And I stayed there for 2 years, actually. It's one of the most beautiful jobs you can have. But I think it's a great, in my opinion, a great way to end your career, not to start it, because politics or institutions don't have like talent management processes, they don't have really career processes. So I quickly realized you got a lot of skills on how to be a politician, but not necessarily transferable skills. And so that's why I left, but it was an amazing experience and I might go back very long down the road.
And you, Auri?
Cool. So way more conventional background and story. So I used to be a strategy consultant. I started working at Brennan Berger in London, mainly in the private equity practice, so working with a PE client. And so I spent 3 years there, learned a lot, and then moved to Octopus Venture, which is kind of a fairly agnostic fund in London.
Large fund.
So when I was back then, it was kind of still fairly agnostic. So they were doing from, you know, seed to Series C, kind of investing across the board. But then, you know, at the moment, they've kind of specialized quite a lot. So they're only doing at the moment like deep tech, health tech, and fintech. But when I was there, it was, as I said, fairly agnostic. So I spent a couple of months there, and then I met the Samaipata team. I loved the approach, which was super different to what I was doing, because hyper-specialized, so only kind of seed and only investing in marketplaces, so kind of different to what I've been exposed to. And I was hired to basically open the office in Paris. So I'm Parisian. I'm from Paris originally. So I kind of came back to Paris with Samaipata a bit more than 2 years ago.
So what is the big picture? What is Samaipata at the very end?
Yeah, I think actually, and Ari's comment is a very good introduction. Basically, Samaipata is born, many of you will know, is founded by José del Barrio, who was also the founder of La Nevera Roja. After exiting it to Rocket and Just Eat, he launched Samaipata with Eduardo Díaz de Hochlinger. So basically, it is born as a pan-European fund specialized in digital platforms and marketplaces. So as opposed to many funds that are local and generalist, we are pan-European and specialized. And the reason is that we believe that in order to be experts, you can be a better expert if you're specialized. Mm-hmm. And we obviously have that operational background into digital platforms and marketplaces. Now, they started from Spain at the very beginning. They did invest in France and in the UK, but directly from Madrid. And then it is when Auri and I joined that this kind of hyper-local strategy in multiple locations is born out of the belief that because we invest in pre-series A, so we go in quite early, you need to be in the ecosystem if you want to, one, get access to the best deals and to be able to build the relationships needed to then help your companies go on and raise series A. And so that is kind of, I agree, when I met Samaipata, and this is the main reason why I also moved from Felix, was like, it is a very kind of differentiated and interesting approach, not only as a value proposition for entrepreneurs, which it is, but also as for investors to actually execute on that strategy. It's quite exciting.
And you mentioned digital platforms. What is that? What do you mean by that?
So we actually come up with a semi-pattern definition of what we mean by platform, because, you know, it's a kind of a, depends on the, you know, the taxicon, many, but can mean everything
exactly.
Basically. So the way we define it at Samaipata is basically a digital framework that encapsulates a many-to-many relationship. And so that's the first thing. And the second thing is the digital interface needs to command the role of the interaction. So it's kind of a two-fold definition. And more kind of more pragmatically, it kind of englobes a number of business model. So kind of traditional marketplaces, SaaS-enabled marketplaces, market networks, aggregator, exchange. So any type of business model that has this kind of many-to-many relationship.
Business to business included?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's very interesting because we've gone so deep into understanding what platform is that actually one of the most kind of trivia is a personal computer is a platform because it allows others to build on top of it, right? We would never invest in personal computer because it's mainly hardware, but that's a different thing. The idea with the platform is it's a digital framework or a digital system that enables the interaction between many-to-many sites. So whatever the site is, whatever the site is made up of, as long as you have that framework that enables and provides the rules for that interaction, and whatever that interaction be, it can be a formal transaction, but it can be communication, be anything, that is a digital platform.
Okay, and you do this, well, of course, in France and UK, also in Spain, that you have your headquarters here, I believe, but also you do stuff in Italy, right?
Yeah. So we have from Madrid, we cover Spain, Italy, and Portugal.
Okay.
So we are able to cover kind of Italy and Portugal from Madrid because it's kind of smaller ecosystems still. And we have an office in Paris and an office in London.
Yeah.
And so the reason, coming back to this kind of pan-European approach that we have, so the reason why we have this kind of decentralized offices across Europe is because we really want to kind of invest in a potential European category leader. So at minima European, obviously global, if possible. And we actually believe that it's hard to do so as a VC if you don't have this operational European footprint for two reasons. A, the fact that we invest so early into company that it's super hard to benchmark teams across Europe if you're not, you know, kind of in the ecosystem to be able to actually meet those teams and identify them. You know, at seed, you need to be on the ground to meet the entrepreneurs. And second, it's obviously harder to help your portfolio company expand abroad. if you don't have this kind of upper footprint in other geography in order to help them, setting up businesses, in Spain, for instance, because like, for instance, France, Spain is quite an interesting market as the first internationalization strategy. So yeah, and for those two reasons, we think it's super important that we have this kind of local offices.
Basically. And basically how we actually execute is we right now in Fund 1, we had three core regions, which was UK, France, and Southern Europe. And Southern Europe, it's headquartered in Madrid, but it's Portugal, Spain, and Italy.
No Germany, right?
So Germany is Fund 2, and we just opened an office in Germany now. So in Fund 2, we'll have four geographies that we cover. Under that thesis, we're close to the entrepreneur. We give them on-the-ground support, but a pan-European network in every sense, be it fundraising, be it talent, be it clients. And at the same time, as investors, we get access to the best deals, and we're embedded in the network as insiders.
And what is it like covering a big city like London or Paris with just one person?
Tricky.
Yeah, it's good that you can't see our faces in this podcast.
The big team.
Yeah. We look quite tired. No, I think, so basically in Fund 2, we will grow the team, hopefully. But I think you just...
My dream.
Yeah, we're all waiting for it. But I think you just need to... I think it was one of the things that made us... that made the Fund 1 a good fund in the sense of access to deal flow and deals is the fact that we were very aware we were just one person covering a very large region. That makes you, like, that forces you have no option but to focus and to be super efficient, right? So we're laser focused. It really helps that we are so specific into, we are pretty serious A, digital platforms and marketplaces, and that's it. And so that really helps to kind of create a brand and stick into people's minds. And then we just target the deal flow sources so like laser focus. That really helps as well. And then we did a lot of groundwork that didn't immediately have an ROI, but that does a couple of years after, into creating a brand that is powerful on that kind of specialization. So we did a lot of events, we sponsor a lot of like community activities and like network based, and produce a lot of content all around creating a brand that is very differentiated, and that is paying off now. But it's been quite a ride.
Yeah, but the two things that enables us to be quite efficient as a single investment professional in a country is, as Carmen said, the fact that we are hyper specialized. So in terms of kind of deal flow, it's quite focused. And second, the fact also that I don't know about the UK, but at least in France, the market is quite concentrated on Paris. So depending on the data source, kind of 80% of deals is. Is in Paris. So basically, it allows you to be quite focused also geographically. So I mean, obviously, there's awesome companies outside of Paris, but obviously, like you, it's harder to kind of build this kind of footprint outside of it. So having access to 80% of the deal in a single city also allows you to kind of. To be quite present.
I think in the UK it's a bit more distributed, and there's a lot of public effort to make it distributed. Actually, the concentration and the density in London, if you take either the population or the GDP, is not as high as in other places. That makes sense. But in terms of volume, absolute numbers, it is like it has no comparison. But you have Cambridge, you have Oxford, you even have Edinburgh, Belfast. The thing with us, though, again going back, is because you're one person, you become ruthless in being focused. So you need to sacrifice things like, as in, okay, I'm obviously not going to Belfast right now. Now in Fund 2, like we do and we build those relationships. The beauty of the UK though is, even though there's a lot of deal flow outside London, it all comes to London. Mm-hmm. So it is not impossible. We've looked at a lot of companies of outside London. Actually, the opportunities are very, very interesting, but you don't necessarily need to go to there, but and it's a plan for us in Fund 2 to expand into those geographies. But in Fund 1, we were like super focused of like, let's minimize the traveling within the UK.
How big was Fund 1?
30 million.
30 million. And how do you relate with what you were saying? How do you compete? Because well, I mean, these ecosystems are much mature, much more mature than Spain. There are many players that have been doing this business for decades. And how do you compete? Well, probably France a bit less, but how do you compete with these funds which are actually trying to close the same deal.
I guess the question is quite different between Paris and London.
The French, your French thing, and then I'll do my British one.
So the thing is, so as far as Paris is concerned, so the ecosystem is booming, but it's still kind of not as mature as London. So basically, the Paris as a tech hub was kind of really became super dynamic kind of in the last 5 years, I would say. And at least the seed kind of space is structuring itself. So basically, you've got, like, I would say, kind of three type of potential competitors. You've got business angels, you know, and second-time founders. So people, entrepreneurs that basically sold their company for like X amount of money, that reinvesting, you know, the capital gain into the ecosystem. And those business angels are starting to kind of structure themselves into syndicates. So it's already done in London, from what I understood. In Paris, it's starting. So those business angels, we do not see them as competitors, because what tends to happen is we co-invest with them.
So you source deals from them.
Yeah, we source deals from them, and also we're quite open to leaving a share of the round kind of free for them to co-invest with us. So we see them more as a source of deal flow and a way to kind of fill the cap table with kind of specific value add on different functions. You know, so that's the first bucket. Second bucket is kind of Series A fund, so kind of established brand, kind of moving upstream, because obviously the Series A landscape is quite competitive in Paris at the moment. Same thing is that obviously sometimes we compete head to head, but those funds tend to target second time entrepreneurs, so like big kind of 6 million pre-seed round at huge valuation, which is not necessarily the type of round that we focus on. So once again, those guys, we're not that. We have a collaborative relationship more than a competitor relationship, I would say. And the third bucket is kind of seed funds. There's a bit more of obviously competitive tension, but there's two types of seed funds. So as Carmen said before, you know, there's some of them are fairly agnostic, you know, and you know, here is true that we compete with them, but there's not that many in Paris, you know, pure seed fund. And second, some of them actually also specialized and typically specialized in areas where we do not invest. For instance, kind of seed deep tech funds, for instance. So there's also some kind of complementary in the deal flow here. So it's quite interesting because there's increasingly competition, I won't lie. But our specific approach allow us to have some kind of differentiated messaging. Also the fact that the fact that we're entrepreneur led, the fact that we are we have this kind of pan-European approach plus the specialization, both in terms of models and in terms of stage of investment, kind of contributes to the fact that we have a clear messaging on the market.
Because when you say you invest in pre-Series A, I mean, what kind of ticket size is that?
So I'll respond to that and then I'll go to you. So basically our average ticket size is 1 to 1.3 million, 1.5, because we play with currencies here with the pound and the euro, but 1 to 1.5. We take around 80% of the round because we aim at having plus 15% ownership stake. So that gives you a little bit of the flair in the size of rounds that we take part in and also in the valuation. Now, that wasn't like that in fund one, because with 30 million fund, mm-hmm. your average ticket size, our average ticket size was across geographies around 500K in the UK, obviously a bit larger. But I think that on top of Auri's very exhaustive segmentation of the market, which very much
appreciated.
Yeah, and very much applies.
So I won't,
definitely, it's a great framework. So I won't get into that. But I think there are two interesting points to make on how do you compete in new geographies that are very mature. So one, and like more like a by principle, I think the beauty of venture capital is that the barriers of entry are very low, as if for new players to become, like, everybody or every fund could be the next kind of Sequoia 10 years from now, right? That cannot be done in other industries. It's not possible. Here, it's about finding the right deal with the track record. You can actually make it. So yes, obviously, other more established funds have like those circles going by which they see better deal flow, although the opportunity, like the chances they get better deals is better, but you can break into that, right? And now the second thing is, how do you compete with very small tickets? How do you lead rounds? I think in our thesis was because we are, as Ari was saying, so specialized, and we have not only the kind of knowledge as investors from having seen hundreds and hundreds of digital platforms, but we have the operating expertise. We have not lost or missed a deal when we've had the founder in front of us, as in once they talk to us and they realize like the kind of questions we ask, the kind of value we give back, because we obviously give input back, it's a reciprocity-based process, they want to work with us. In the UK, we've even managed to generate around in one of the cases around what they were not raising, but they just like sat down with Jose and me and wanted the money, right? But you need to get them first. You need to get to them first. If you don't, then it's very difficult, because brand name-wise, 2 years ago, and money-wise, we were behind. Now it's not like that. Now for digital platforms, we have a lot of advocates, business angels, as you mentioned, founders in our portfolio, entrepreneurs we've worked with, but we passed on, but they still are advocates for us. And that starts to, as in the very specific pre-series A digital platform space, we start to be very, or a bit more well-known. And now we have the firepower in Fund 1, in Fund 2 to kind of put larger tickets. But in Fund 1, again, it went back to being very efficient, very focused, understand the type of founders. We would never go for second time successful, rounds of 7 million pre-launch, which happened in the UK very much. So you need basically another thing that in the UK strategy was like, well, I'm going to go for founders that have like first time founders, but then know their industry upside down. So one of our founders has been a lawyer for 7 years, Linklater. She's doing legal tech. Sam from Geomic was 12 years a design engineer. He's built a marketplace for R&D design engineers and manufacturers of prototypes. Like, you need those people who understand the market, even though they don't have entrepreneurship experience. So it's just about understanding what you can do and where to do it, rather than trying to go for everything, because we couldn't compete on many fronts, I agree.
So having seen so many marketplaces, you probably can benchmark them one to the others. So what do you look for, or especially, I mean, putting myself in the shoes of the founders, I mean, when should I come to Samaipata, when I have what kind of metrics, or when it comes to marketplaces, what do you look for in those marketplaces at that early stage?
Yeah, so the first thing is that, surprisingly enough, so we invest quite early, but we're super analytical.
We're like, Germans, basically.
So we spend a lot of time on data. So obviously it depends on how much data you have, you know, how long ago did you launch the business. But the way we work is, so we do not really think in terms of kind of first meetings, second meetings, partner meetings, you know, as other funds. But each kind of deal lead or country lead basically work in sprint. So a bit like developers, basically. So the first sprint is quite analytical, as I said. So we spend quite a lot of time in looking at your operational KPIs. So we spend more time typically looking at historicals rather than forecast, because you know, we've built a business plan for our portfolio company,
like, and we know how. Don't bullshit a bullshitter. Please edit this.
So as I said, first week, quite a lot of focus on operational KPIs, especially cohorts. So we've built a model internally that we've published. So we kind of usually typically recalculate and restructure the cohorts. Market sizing, competitive benchmark. So it's quite objective as a first sprint. So and then we have some kind of pre-investment committee. And then we have a second sprint, which is more about digging into questions that we've identified, and dig into personal fit, because we quite involved post investment, and we want to make sure that we can have this kind of healthy and sound relationship with the team moving forward. So to come back to your question, I said that the first thing is that we invest in seed, but we spend a lot of time on data, which is kind of counterintuitive.
And we also spend a lot of time helping our founders afterwards setting up the right data. I think one thing that I keep telling founders is, especially when your job or your main thing to optimize for when you go from seed to Series A, obviously you need to grow, but you need more than growing, you need to understand where that growth is coming from, right? So you need to optimize for speed of learning. And it is very difficult to optimize for speed of learning if you're not tracking things. You need to be able to track everything as granular as possible, even if data is small, even if you get a lot of zeros because you have very small cohorts. Of course, it doesn't matter, but you're learning and you're shortening the feedback loops of learning, implementing actions and learning from that impact and iterating, right? If you don't do that, it is very hard to understand your levers of growth. And if you don't understand your levers of growth, it is very hard to then put to work 10 million when you raise a Series A. So that is kind of a key part of it, why we look for data kind of driven in founders. I think in summary, and because I know that VC is not very transparent and founders have a hard time understanding how we think and what we look for. So if you would like to summarize and going back to some of the points Aoi was mentioning, we look for founder market fit, as I said. So founders with a secret, they're insiders in their market. This is generic. This is not just for marketplaces. Works for everything. We put a lot of time in why now and beyond. So why is it now the time for this to work? Is it like technology driven? Is it a socioeconomic trend? We work a lot. We're very thematic in those sense. We work a lot around trends. And then this is also generic. It doesn't need to apply only for marketplaces. Now, for digital platforms and marketplaces, we do think about why digital platforms in this sector. So there are sectors that are especially kind of suited for to be disrupted by a platform, others where it might not work as well. So we do spend a lot of time trying to understand what the drivers in each sector are and whether a digital platform is the right model for it. And then when going back to more unit economics and data points, so we invest in businesses that are defensible and scalable. And this is why we believe in platforms per se. As Aoi was saying before, we look for European or global champions. If you want to be a global champion or a European champion, you need to be able to get big enough and to defend that position, right? So you need to be scalable and defensible. We do not invest in deep tech. We do not invest in the development of new technology. So the tech per se is not defensible. We need to look for additional modes of defensibility. And we believe that network effect, which are very kind of inherent to platforms, are a very strong source of defensibility. This is why we believe in the rise of platforms as the models that can disrupt a lot of the key sectors we're focused in, because they can get big enough and they can defend their position. And how do we measure that? So scalability, and this is way more complex. We look at a lot more things, but if as a founder, you need to kind of stick to a couple of points. CAC LTV, so your unit economics, and they don't necessarily need to work now, but they need to be able to work in the future. And here a lot of components come into place, your average order value, your margins, the repeat, the retention. That's all very important. And that links also to the cohorts point, which is probably if we were to choose one thing that we could look at, it would be the cohorts, because it gives you a lot of information around the behavior of customers, both demand and supply side, with your product or service. And it also brings a lot of hints around defensibility. So I think that having that in place is very important when you go talk to your investor. To know your business is key.
So the last idea is that we also, when you look at the our kind of DNA, we are also quite, we strive to be quite contrarian in the business we like to invest in. So I think it was a partner from YC that says basically the best businesses are kind of a good idea that looks like bad idea. So typically Airbnb at the beginning. And it's typically the type of mindset that we try to kind of adopt when we look at deals and we during our investment committee. So really trying to find those businesses that have really a strong why now and this kind of disruption kind of built in the model.
And basically, that's a hard one to do, actually, because you don't only need to be contrarian, as in not following consensus, but you need to be right, which is not, because, I mean, if you do not follow consensus and you're wrong, then it's not really a point. So, but yeah, any entrepreneur who's like getting rejected by others, come see us. We won't consider that as a negative.
And may I ask you something about the future? How you see Europe in the future? I mean, you've got a different point of view. You, well, the Brexit
now
going
I'm not
on.
Europe anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
I woke up the other weekend and I was
how
not
see,
in the
how
EU.
How you see Europe from the outside? No.
Honestly, it was a really weird feeling to go, like, to sleep in Europe and wake up outside the European Union. It was a weird feeling.
Well, how you see the ecosystem? Like, okay, so the Brexit is going on. I don't know. How is it? I mean, probably in 5 years it's going to have something going on there. What's your point of view about the European ecosystem?
Yeah, so what I find interesting is that when you look at, you know, the number of years it takes to create a kind of a European hub, this length is actually shortening. Like, you know, Berlin, it took 8 to 10 years. Paris, it took 5 years. When you look at markets such as Milan or Lisbon, the speed is even increasing. So what you have in Europe at the moment is that you've got, it used to be tiered already, you know, with kind of a, everything started in the Nordics and then and London. Then you've got like a second tier, which was kind of fast growing but sizable markets, so Berlin, Paris. And then you've got the third tier, which was the kind of more Southern Europe hubs and Eastern Europe now. So so those kind of tiers are, you know, the third tiers are catching up quite quickly. So I think it's interesting because there's a lot of opportunities outside of the obvious markets. So that's the first thing. Then when you think, you know, as far as France is concerned, so the market is, as I said, is booming. Most of it because, you know, it used to be, or it's still actually a subsidized, publicly subsidized country as far as tech is concerned. So either kind of direct subsidy, so money injected via the, you know, the BPI into the ecosystem, in funds or directly into startups or
in France.
What?
Vive la France.
Or indirectly, yeah. You know, with the kind of public initiative around visa or fiscality, for instance. So it's this kind of, you know, kind of public dynamism.
Boost, yeah.
Yeah, public boost, exactly, has basically turned the country into a really attractive scene. Hence why so many kind of foreign funds are recruiting to cover France. Yeah. So it's becoming quite quite competitive at the moment, and you can see it in valuation going up the roof. So so let's see what's going to happen. But I think the next 2 years, at least for like for France, are going to be quite interesting.
Do you see a negative side about the, of course, apart from the competition, do you see a negative side about all this public injection of money? So well, at least from this side of the Pyrenees, it seems like, wow, super crazy. Like, I mean,
I
wow,
love
that
this side of the Pyrenees.
Yeah, it's really cool. Like it's like it's well, been amazing what you've done. Yeah.
Well, if it's sustained, then it's positive. The question mark becomes when it stops, basically, oh, <okay. laughs> because you know it's. I'm not talking about now, but like you know, a couple of years ago, it was basically fake it until you make it. So you basically, it was kind of the you know the entire ecosystem was kind of pumped into public subsidy. So so at the moment the barrier to creating a company are quite low. You know, like finding you know enough money for the first a few hundred Ks at the beginning, it's manageable. So at the moment, it's quite positive. You know, a lot of it, to be honest, a lot of it from a foreign perspective is marketing, like you know the okay. X hundreds of millions that Macron announce every 6 months. You know, the a few months ago it was 5 billion. You know, two of them dedicated growth funds. So a lot of it's marketing. Let's see what actually gets implemented. But yeah, like it's keeping the ecosystem high. if it's sustained, it's good. There's a bit of I don't like to talk about bubble, but like the barrier to creating a company are low. So yeah, at the moment, it's
I think it's very interesting when you compare France and the UK because the model that the UK follow is completely different. So the UK created a scheme very much like Anglo-Saxon private money incentivizing private investment. They follow they create a scheme called SEIS by which they basically foster investments by high net worth individuals, but making it very, very, very tax efficient to a point by which if you need to pay, let's say this is very rich people, but 100K to for taxes, actually you may as well invest those 100K in taxes into a startup, and you get the potential upside, right? Mm. And if you lose it, there's no lose situation because you would have paid it to taxes yeah. anyways, right?
That's so amazing system.
It is, and so they, it has enabled, basically, it has met this spot from like 0 to 750K raising, which is usually tough. Now in the UK, it's like kind of sorted in the sense that there's so much money for that space. Now, when you look at the market and in, at Sama Ipata, we strongly believe in Europe. Like we do believe in Europe as a tech ecosystem, and we believe the fact that Europe will boom in the next few years. But when you look at an ecosystem, I think you, or how I look at it is, you look at talent, you look like access to talent and price of the talent, you look at the size of the market from like a consumer perspective, you look at access to capital, and you look at regulation, right? And that's what defines like how to benchmark market versus others. If you look at talent of Europe versus US, not so much within Europe, we have more developers than the US has. They're distributed, which allows to create more sustainable kind of ecosystems, and they're at a better price. So that is in Europe, I think in that has a very, very strong competitive advantage. Now our market is very fragmented. It is made up of many countries with different languages, different cultural barriers, which is not the same as a like completely only single market as the US is. So that is difficult, especially on the consumer side. It's much harder to get to very big exits in the UK or in Europe than it is in the States. Now, when it comes to access to capital, and this is where ecosystems, how developed they are in the US, it's much more, and it's also much more liquid for exits, right? But I think that can be fixed. That can be fixed with like initiatives like the UK or like the French. And it's a matter of time that we catch up. Also because they're seeing a lot of, and this comes back to the negative side of having too much money in the system, they're seeing a lot of kind of dysfunctional behaviors and situations, which actually are translating into the US funds coming into Europe. And now there's a lot of press around that, Lightspeed, Sequoia, like 14W, they're all opening offices in Europe because like it's becoming harder and harder to make bigger returns at US prices. And then the fourth one where I think the US is also much more advanced when we talk about like startups only and it's regulation, right? In Europe, in fact, one of the arguments for Brexit, the strongest arguments for people who support Brexit, is that if outside of the European Union, they freed themselves on the European regulation, which is far more constrained and bureaucratic than what they wish. So actually in the UK, there's a concern about talent with Brexit, obviously. There's a concern about access to capital, but there's quite some optimism when it comes down to regulation because people assume that there will be kind of a move towards way more liberal regulation that will promote and foster like more Anglo-Saxon way of doing business versus Europe. So,
But coming back to something Carlos was saying, so the problem in Europe at the moment is not money coming in, is money coming out, basically. And, it's also related to the point on is there any negative side on, being a subsidized, for instance, economy, as long as France is concerned, is that. So it's funny because we are in the process of raising a fund, and we've been talking to a number of US investors, so US LPs, and something that they keep saying about Europe, which is quite interesting, is the fact that they don't really understand why VC are so protective of their deal flow and are not really sharing deals. And I'm talking about VC at a similar kind of stage. In terms of co-investment, in terms of so you identify an interesting opportunity, and then you pick up your phone and you basically invite your fellow VC, another, for instance, Series A investor into the cap table. And basically, where they've been challenging us quite a lot is, well, what happens in San Francisco is that there's this opportunity, Sequoia Invest, and then Benchmark Invest afterwards, and so on. And then, it becomes some kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, because the thing is, when you kind of concentrating half of the value resources in terms of capital, value-add talent,
network,
whatever, yeah. And it, yeah, like pure network effect, yeah. Basically, then the team that might not have been the winning team becomes the winning team, you know? And they were like, well, what we find interesting is that we do not see this type of behavior in Europe, like, I'm not going to name the tier one VC basically investing in the company and becoming quite protective.
Because they're very stake driven, we don't have big exits, right? But there's this whole theory on whether that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because by being stake driven, we limit the potential upside, as opposed to sharing is caring and creating altogether a huge. It is to be seen, it's theoretical, but it's true that in Europe, you're kind of forced to be very stake driven because the exits are not as big.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say that. Actually, something that we've been missing is like the corporates in Europe, even though they might be big, they don't buy stuff.
Yeah. No, they prefer to build.
Yeah, exactly. So which is, I mean, there is something missing there, which is the end picture, right?
100%. Yeah, yeah. So that was exactly my point, in the sense where when you're fighting for a piece of a cake that is 200 million max, it's not the same thing where you have you can have a 5% of Netflix, you know?
It's quite different. I think this point is very interesting, and for founders to understand how a VC works, and for founders to understand that it's not that we're greedy and want to take over their business, but basically for our unit economics to work, our own unit economics as fund, we need to maximize for ownership, because if you have a set size of a fund, which is always the case, then kind of absolute volume in money you need to return to make the returns depends on this, on like your ownership. So the more ownership you have, the easier you have a fund returner. Let's see, if you own 20% of a company and you have a 100 million fund, you need a 500 million exit to get 100 million and return the fund. If you own 1%, do the math, right? So this is why in Europe, because we don't assume that, like, we can't, or we don't have any facts or proofs to assume that exits can be billions, we need to focus on grabbing a lot of ownership stake. So, but I think it's important for founders, and I do always explain like the little formula, in the sense that it is not that we want to take over your business, it's that we need that stake for our unit own unit economics to work. Because if we own 1% of your company, you basically need to be like exits in billions. If we own 20%, you can exit at 500 million and we will return our funds. So.
Yeah, so that's the kind of the biggest challenge, at least the way we see it in Europe at the moment, is that making sure that all the money that's coming in is going to come out at some point, and that the kind of above 200 million exit is going to, you know, become more standard moving forward.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Before the unicorn type of exit start to materialize.
So to wrap up, because I believe you have to go, the two last questions that we always make in the podcast, can you recommend us a book or some piece of content and someone to invite to the podcast that hasn't come yet?
So I'll go first. I will break my own rule and recommend actually something business. So for me, The Strategy, which is a newsletter written by Ben Thompson. This is this guy who lives in Taiwan just from writing content. For me, he's the best thinker in tech. Very hard to spell, but Strategy. Strategy. That the way that guy thinks about everything tech related is amazing.
That's nice.
Yeah,
that's
new. So a lot of people don't. It's very interesting.
It's $10 a month.
No, yeah. But it has no.
I pay it.
But it has free content. You can get
a
newsletter every
article.
Exactly weekly, which is way worth it. I mean, I would pay for that weekly article. So he has a brilliant post on Amazon acquiring Whole Foods, on Shopify becoming a platform, on like Microsoft versus like Apple. It is really like an amazing thinker. And then in terms of who you should interview. it's a tricky one for such a
evil smile.
Yeah, evil smile. No, I think relevant for founders, I would actually say two. I think if you want a founder, you should interview a guy called Johnny from Hopin, Hopin. And that is a platform to create end-to-end online events, not offline to online, just end-to-end online events, that is allowing a lot of people to monetize their online communities. And it's allowing a lot of meetups, going beyond the writing, which is very important, especially now that communities are global, mm-hmm. and because they are by theme, not by geographic affiliation. So that's super interesting. And he is quite a character. He is like a wonderful character.
Where's he from?
he's from London, but I'm sure he'll be happy to speak to you. If I did. And also, if you want more like the kind of VC and even LP approach, but like that combination, I think one of the best thinkers I've come across, and a lot of this theory around the state-driven and the US and stuff, and we discuss a lot, is a girl called Laura from Corellia. Corellia is a VC fund that also does LP, but she's French and already knows her as well. And they're really good thinkers into the ecosystem, and they have the view of an LP as well, so they can give you like the view of LP versus VCs and VCs entrepreneurs. So that's good.
We'll ask for the interest.
No worry, you got them.
So in terms of books, so I'm quite bad at tech books. Usually I'm always starting them and never finishing them. But the last, the latest one I've read, actually I think I finished this one, is the one, so it's on the Secret of Sand Hill Road, yeah. By Scott Cooper, which is one of the partners at Andreessen. And it's a bit like VC 101, but for entrepreneurs it's super useful because it explains how VC thinks, how the VC kind of the VC world is structured, and it also gives you the kind of US approach in terms of terms, for instance, in terms of benchmarks. So it's quite interesting. And then in terms of person to interview next. So I guess if you want to kind of continue on the European mindset conversation, a good one would be to interview one of the partners of First, called Pierre. It's one of the newest seed funds in Paris. And they have, they share the same belief in Europe, on Europe as a continent. I think that would be an interesting one.
Great.
Ari, Carmen, thanks a lot for coming.
No, thank you for having us.
And we'll be back next week. See you.
Bye.